I think I've spoken quite a lot in the last 9 or 10 days. But maybe a few more things that may be practical advice for you. So we've been wandering around the Buddhist supermarket for the last 9 or 10 days. And now we've come to the checkout. And if you have something in your trolley to take home, don't do what I did many years ago when I attended my first 10-day course on Buddhism. My trolley, I think, was overflowing with lots of good stuff, and I took it home and arranged it nicely on the shelves, and that's where it stayed for some time. So if you found something useful in the last 10 days, don't just leave it as some sort of nice idea, some nice memory, but rather use it, integrate it into your life. Otherwise, it's just a nice idea. Of course, you don't need to buy everything at the Buddhist supermarket. You can pick those things that you find beneficial now. There may be some things there that you don't believe in or don't find to be of any use to you, then just leave them on the shelf and maybe later they'll be useful. You don't need to become a Buddhist to shop at the Buddhist supermarket. In fact, here I think we can follow some advice from His Holiness Dalai Lama, who says, and this often he does when he gives talks in the West to large public audience where most of the people are not Buddhist. He often says, please don't convert to Buddhism. Because if you grew up with a tradition that is benefiting you, then if you try to convert or change to Buddhism, you may have create some confusion and also maybe some difficulties with your family or community. Rather, he says, if you find something useful in what I say, then use it to become a better Christian, Muslim, Hindu, atheist. And then he goes on often to say that if you grew up in a tradition or religion that's not benefiting you, or you don't have a particular tradition, then eventually you may, if you want, then you can decide to become Buddhist. But again, the main thing is not what you call yourself, but what you do with your life. So again, more important is to implement ideas to become a better person rather than just walking around saying, I'm this, I'm that. Another piece of advice is, I think I already mentioned it earlier, but please don't force any of your family and friends to shop at the Buddhist supermarket. Of course, if they're very open to these ideas, then by all means explain them. But if they're not, and particularly elder people tend to be more set in their ways, if you try and force these ideas onto your mother, father, grandparents, uncle, aunt, so forth, you may have the reverse effect, because we don't like anything forced on us, even if it's the best thing for us. So if people are very closed in their perspective, then don't force, rather lead by example, and then they may ask you what you're doing, that you're now becoming a much better person. So that's how to help people who are more closed. Of course, we've looked at many things, many topics here, in this Lam Rim Chenmo over the last 9 or 10 days. And it's only a brief overview of these topics. Of course, we can see from the Mahayana that it's a very vast path with lots of different practices. So then often the question is, well, where do we start? Of course, here in general in the Lam Rim, it was structured in a step-by-step way, so we can see what builds on which practices. But I think within that, particularly based on our modern society, I think often a good place to start is if we find our mind is completely chaotic, very distracted, very dull, then I think it's good in the beginning phases to emphasize the shamatha practice, because if we try to do any of these other practices while our mind is completely distracted or dull, they're not really going to make, you're not going to make much progress. And also, if our mind is in that state, we're not really being that effective in our life anyway. So it's going to help us to be more effective in everything else. So I think if we find that our mind is in that state, I think one of the practices that we can emphasize as a beginner is the shamatha practice. Again, whether we're focusing on the breath, the mind, or some mental image, it doesn't really matter. Pick an object that you want to work with, comfortable with, and then really work on relaxing, stabilizing, and making the mind more clear. So I think we can't go wrong with that as a beginner. But of course, not just do that, but also I think in our modern society, we tend to have a lot of this sort of self-cherishing attitude. And often we do a lot of this cognitive fusion, and so many of us are suffering from guilt and low self-esteem and maybe even some self-hatred. So I think if that's the case, then we would be very helpful as a beginner to also focus on these four immeasurables practices: loving kindness, compassion, and particularly empathetic joy, in that we, in our modern society, we tend to always focus on the negative and with cognitive fusion. So empathetic joy is going to give us a more balanced view of ourselves and others, is to really focus on the positives in ourselves and others and rejoice in that, this empathetic joy. And of course, the mind of equanimity, so that we can stop being biased towards others. So I think these four practices as a beginner are going to be very helpful for us. And again, with the loving kindness and compassion, if we're not feeling good about ourselves, that's where we need to start. We need to start developing loving kindness and compassion for ourselves, because if we're not feeling good about ourselves, then we won't be able to extend it out to others. So I think these two practices, for many of us, could be a very good place to start. And then on that basis, of course, we can follow a step-by-step approach to practice as suggested here in the Lam Rim. And then some advice when we go home. First is to avoid unrealistic expectations. I mean, in general, expectations are going to become an obstacle. Of course, we need to understand the goal, we need to understand the practice, how to achieve that goal, but then we need to work in the present moment towards that goal. And if we're always caught up in this expectation, then we're just trapped in the hope-fear cycle, hoping for something nice to happen, fearing or worrying about something unpleasant happening. So I think we need to drop expectations in general. And in particular here, another expectation that I sort of got caught up originally in was expecting that simply by now having some new perspective of my life, some new ideas, that somehow automatically my life would improve, that my life would go in a good direction automatically. I think that's not going to happen. Because again, intellectual understanding is not driving our behavior. So to have this expectation that now you've found some new ideas, that when you go home, somehow automatically your life will head in a good direction, I think this is completely unrealistic. We need to implement these ideas. We need to internalize them. We need to integrate them in our life. If we do that, then, of course, we can start to head in a better new direction. And here, of course, we're talking about transforming our mind, transforming our attitudes. Another thing we need to be careful about is not making a big display about this. For two reasons. Well, many reasons, but at least two. One is, of course, if we do that, you know, if we go home and say, oh, I'm a Buddhist now and, you know, wear all this funky Buddhist clothing and sometimes people shave their head and so forth, then often with our family and community, we sort of have a few difficulties, you know. Often they think, well, what have they done? They join some cult or something. And also the other point is that if we make a big outward display of it, it's often a sign that our ego has hijacked our good intentions and now we've just become spiritual ego. And like I said before, I think from my what I see, often that's sometimes the worst. Because with that, we think we're the best or superior, and then we often look down on others, and then often because we're now a Buddhist, everything's okay and we don't even work at improving ourselves. So I think we can avoid that. So remember, it's an inner transformation. And in the Lojong teachings, there's a very nice little phrase about talking about transforming the mind, but remain as you are, meaning don't radically change your outward behavior because it's not going to help. It's just going to create problems, and it's a sign that we are simply dressing ourselves as a spiritual ego. Also, of course, we need to... whatever little things have germinated in our mind over these last 10 days, we need to protect and nurture this. It's a bit like a little seed has sprouted out of the ground. If we don't protect and nurture that, it'll just get probably squashed or eaten or something. So likewise, if we don't protect and nurture these things that are maybe starting to develop in our mind now, it will get squashed. So what we need to do there, of course, is, as suggested in the Shamatha section, to have a supportive environment. This is something that I really seem to be emphasizing more and more, in particular this idea of Sangha. I know from my own personal experience and many people I talk to, one of the greatest difficulties people face is that when they go home, they sort of, they're on their own, you know, and they try to implement these things on their own. And as a beginner, for most people, this is more or less impossible because we have strong habits, not good habits often. We have a lot of people and things around us that are really pushing us in a certain direction, and we're trying to move in a new direction. And often people find it too difficult to do on their own. So I think it's very important when we go home to find like-minded people. Doesn't have to be a Buddhist center, but at least find a group of like-minded people, get connected with them, get support from them, support them, and then I think we can have the beginnings of protecting this and then nurturing this and moving forward. Again, from my experience and many people I talk to, if we try and go it alone, I think most of us will find it not sustainable. Also, of course, what can be very helpful is if there are certain very heavy negative influence on us as in our life, maybe things or people, that whenever we come into contact them, it generates a lot of mental afflictions and problems, then maybe the smart thing to do in the short term is to give yourself a little bit of distance from these things or people. Of course, running away is never a long-term solution, but it may be a useful short-term strategy to give yourself a bit of space from these people or things that often just overwhelm us in a negative way that we can't handle, while we work on ourselves so that later we can then be more in those situations and more with those people to work with them. Because continually exposing ourselves as a beginner to these situations where we always get overwhelmed in a negative way is counterproductive. Of course, if it's involving people, we're not talking about cutting from people. We're talking about physical distance, keeping them close to our heart. We're not abandoning them. Also, of course, I think it's very helpful, as suggested in the text here as well, that to continue to read about and reflect on and attend teachings on these various topics to deepen our understanding of them as well. And also, as part of the Shamatha preconditions, it talked about few activities, meaning to simplify our life. Because often, you know, we hear that people want to do these sorts of things, but often people just say, I just don't have time to meditate. Of course, normally with most of us, our busy schedules, that's probably true. But the reality is, of course, that a lot of things that we fill up our day with are not that important and even not so meaningful. So there are, of course, certain core, meaningful, important things that we need to engage in our life. But beyond that, we fill up our life with a lot of stuff just to make ourselves busy and often simply to distract ourselves so we don't have to look at the chaotic state of our mind. So here the solution is not to just try and cut things out of our life forcibly. Rather, a better approach is to reflect on these early topics in the Lamb Room, the precious human life and death. To really reflect on this precious opportunity we have. It's not going to last forever. Let's not be one of these people later in our life who look back on our life and are full of regret. And as I mentioned, there was, this lady in the hospice movement who studied people who are approaching death, and she came up with, over many years, the top five regrets of people who are dying. And the number one top regret for men, but I think it's probably the same for women now, is regretting having worked so hard and not spent time with family and friends and doing other activities. So we need to reflect on precious human life and death so that we can see what's really important in our life, and then all these other activities will fall away. We won't be interested in them. So we won't have to forcibly cut them. And here again, I quoted earlier this quote from Steve Jobs, who I'll mention part of that quote again here related to this, and he said, again to these students at Stanford University, "Remembering that I'll be dead soon is the most important tool I've ever encountered to help me make the big choices in life. Because almost everything, all external expectations or pride or fear of embarrassment or failure, these things just fall away in the face of death, leaving only what is truly important. Remembering that you're going to die is the best way I know to avoid the trap of thinking you have something to lose. You are already naked. There is no reason not to follow your heart." So I think that if we can have this sort of reflection, then we can really prioritize our life. We will have time and energy to devote to meditation and to improving ourselves as a person. And related to that, and I think I already mentioned this earlier, but just to mention again, you know, often people, when they come into this way of thinking, then they often think that they have to make a choice, you know. Should I do the career thing or the spiritual thing, you know? I think this is not a very good way of thinking, because if we give up our career, particularly if it's something that we're talented in and we enjoy doing, then what are we going to do with our life? We can't sit in a cave the rest of our life and meditate. We need to be able to go out and interact in society. And so if we have a talent, then integrate that with spiritual life, and to be able to use your talent in a more meaningful way. Like an example, a couple of years ago when I was in Tushita, exactly this question came up with one student who came to see me. He was an Indian man who was working in marketing, and I don't think he was boasting, but he said he really was quite talented at marketing. He didn't tell me what he was marketing, but probably not anything very meaningful, because he was in this dilemma that this thing that he was talented in was completely not bringing much meaning to him, and he wanted to give it up and go into more spiritual life. And I said, well, no, don't do that, because what are you going to do? I said, rather integrate the two. So you've obviously got some talent in marketing, so use your talent and market things like renewable energy and so forth, you know, market things that are beneficial and useful in our society, then you can use your talent to benefit society. So this, I think, is how we can look at this. Of course, if we're doing a career that we initially went into just with the motivation we can make a lot of money and we actually hate the job and so forth, then maybe we can think about doing something that we really want to do with our life. Because one of the other top five regrets was living a life expected of us, of others, you know, doing things because others expected us to do that rather than that's really what we want to do. So of course, if we're in that category, then maybe we can, you know, really look at doing what we really want to do, use our talents the way we want to. And then of course, as I've mentioned a number of times, practice, if we want to progress, practice involves two parts: meditation and integration into daily life. We need to do both of those if we really want to progress. So to have a daily meditation practice, and then to integrate into daily life, because the key to success is continuity, meaning not only a daily practice, but continue to integrate what we meditate on in daily life. Because if we don't do that, if we simply every morning sit down to meditate and we do that consistently, then any little benefit we received in the morning meditation, if we jump up and run around, mindlessly running around the rest of the day, that will be working against that. So we need to bring that into daily life, integrate, and then we can make some forward progress. So this is, I think, something very important. Also, I think what's going to be very helpful, if we can manage, is that at least once a year, or twice, if possible, but I think here may be difficult for that to do that, is to find and do a retreat or another course or something where you can really immerse yourself back into a particular topic of interest or meditation and really give yourself that boost in the practice. So I think if you can manage that, that would be also very beneficial. And as we saw that the three core practices we saw here in the Lam Rim at each of the levels was ethics, concentration, wisdom. So, of course, ethical foundation. So if we really want a meaningful life, we really need to adopt ethical lifestyle, avoiding harming others and trying to engage in those 10 virtues as much as we can. And then, of course, on that basis, the concentration practice, the shamatha practice, to make our mind serviceable, because this is going to really be the basis of not only the wisdom practice, but all other practices. If our mind is not serviceable, if our mind is not calm, clear, focused, we're not going to be very effective in any other meditation practice, and we're not going to be very effective in our daily life in general. So then, of course, the wisdom practice. We talked a lot here about this wisdom of emptiness. But, of course, one of the wisdoms that very much supports that is this wisdom of impermanence, is really coming to appreciate and realize that things are changing moment by moment. Of course, we all intellectually accept that now, but, again, if we can really internalize that, if we can experientially come to see that things are changing moment by moment, then that's going to be very helpful in initially reducing a lot of our attachments and aversions. Because if we can see that things are in a constant state of flow and change, then there's nothing really to grab, nothing really to push against. So this, I think, is something we can work on. It's not something that requires blind belief. It's proven. It's a fact. We know that. We just need to internalize that fact. And then we can bring a lot of benefit. And also, if we can really internalize that at a deeper level, then really, to really realize that things are changing moment by moment is actually very close to realizing emptiness. So it's going to be a very good basis for our emptiness practice as well. But of course, as we saw in the Lam Rim, that the wisdom aspect of the practice needs to be balanced with the other factor of merit or compassion. So we need to make sure that we have that balance, because as we saw earlier, if we just go into shamatha, just vipassana practice, then often people who only do these in a very intense way often become very self-absorbed, very disconnected from the world, and often very insensitive to the sufferings of others. So we really don't want to go that way. So we need to make sure we balance that with the compassion wing of the practice, again, through these four immeasurables practices, loving kindness, compassion, empathetic joy, equanimity. And then on top of that, if we can work on those two methods to really try to develop this bodhicitta motivation. Then in terms of how to structure the day, I think Venerable Dholma talked a little bit about meditation practice, so I won't really talk so much about that. Just mention a few words there. Of course, in the morning, generally it's the best time to do the meditation practice because it's when we're most fresh, most quiet where we are, and it's a good way to start the day. So, of course, it's always good in the morning as part of that to set a good motivation for the day. I have a motivation here from His Holiness Dalai Lama, and it goes like this. He says, "Every day, think as you wake up. Today, I'm fortunate to have woken up. I am alive. I have a precious human life. I'm going to use all my energies to develop myself, to expand my heart out to others, to achieve enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. I'm going to have kind thoughts towards others. I'm not going to get angry or think badly about others. I'm going to benefit others as much as I can. So the short version of that is, every day, think as you wake up, I'm going to benefit others as much as I can. And then with the meditation practice, of course, a couple of points I'll mention again that I've mentioned earlier. It's very helpful to have the meditation practice at the same time each day, because one of the most difficult points with meditation practice is just to develop the habit. And if we keep changing the time we meditate, we're not really developing a habit. Whereas if we try to always do at the same time every day, then it starts to become a habit. And I think modern studies have shown that we need to do things at least 25 to 30 times in a row to start to even develop a habit. And again, quality over quantity. Don't try and meditate too long. And do a fixed amount of time. And I mentioned the reasons why the other day. So that if things are a little bit difficult, we'll persevere. And if things are going well, we finish like that, we'll remember that, we'll be enthusiastic to meditate again. What to meditate on? Again, we have the whole Lam Rim structure there. But as I mentioned just before, as a beginner, I think particularly if our minds are very chaotic, very distracted and dull, then I think one of the things we can emphasize in the morning meditation is the shamatha practice, developing a calm, clear, focused mind through focusing on the breath, the mind, mental image, whatever object we choose. So I think this can be one of the core elements, and of course it's also a good way to start the day in a very calm, clear, focused way with a good motivation. And then on top of that, of course, then to also integrate some of the wisdom and compassion elements of the practice. And also then if there is a particular thing we need to work on, then to bring that in from the Lam Rim, like the precious human life and death and so forth. And again, then we... one other thing, actually, that can be very helpful at the beginning of the day, because remember, we're trying to transform our mind. One thing that can be helpful at the beginning of the day is if there is any particular difficult situation that you're anticipating coming up that day, and often in those difficult situations you tend to react in not a very good way and it's quite messy, what we can do there is rehearse that situation that you anticipate and rehearse it in a way that you would like it to unfold. And don't rehearse it like if it's a situation where you get angry with someone at work always. Don't rehearse it by going, today I'm not going to get angry, I'm not going to get angry, I'm not going to get angry. Because you're just focusing on anger, you'll get angry. Rather, rehearse it in terms of the positive. How you would like it to unfold. That you would be responding in a compassionate way and not taking it personally and so forth. So if we have certain things that we are anticipating coming up that day very difficult and we tend to not handle them very well, then based on these ideas, rehearse on how we would like that to unfold. And if we can do that, that can also prepare us a little bit for that event. So that could be something useful. Of course, during the day, we need to integrate what we meditate on. And again, one of the key factors here is if we want to integrate a lot of these things, to be able to do that, we saw in earlier discussions, mindfulness is the key. Because even if we have a good intention to integrate these things, if we're not being mindful in our daily life, we're just going to be stimulus reaction machines. We're not going to be able to do that. So again, one of the key elements here in daily life is cultivate mindfulness. Of course, it's very good at the beginning of the day to make a strong determination to be mindful. But I think on top of that, in a practical way, as I mentioned, I think earlier, is to have certain triggers that can help us to remind us to be mindful. And that can take many forms, can take the form of specific activities that we do each day that we always make an concerted effort to be mindful, as in brushing the teeth, eating meals and so forth. But also we can use modern technology to give us a little signal at random intervals, the apps on mobile phones, to just give a random signal during the day. When we hear that signal, stop whatever we do, and then for a very short time, not more than 2 or 3 minutes, we apply some mindfulness exercise. Either simply focus on our breathing for 2 or 3 minutes, look at the state of our mind, or some other little short mindfulness exercise. And you'll be surprised at how just a few of these reminders through the day will really help us to start being mindful in our activities. Of course, one of the things that I've very much emphasized in this course that's going to be helpful in the way we behave is, again, avoiding this cognitive fusion, is really, with respect to ourselves and others, to not identify ourselves and others with thoughts, emotions, behaviors, habits, or even personalities. These are all things which we have and people have. If we identify ourselves and others with these things, we're going to be in difficulty because, again, we tend to focus on the negative. We identify ourselves and others with negative thoughts, hope, habits, behaviors. We are simply going to attack people. We're going to get angry at people. We're going to attack ourselves. We're going to get guilt and low self-esteem. So this is not helpful at all because, again, it's based on a wrong perspective. So we need to avoid doing this in the way we think and speak and simply correctly distinguish a person from their thoughts, emotions, behaviors, habits, and so forth. In that way, when we do that with respect to ourselves and others, then we can have compassion for ourselves and others if we or others engage in some negative behavior, and at the same time not accept that negative behavior and either help that person to overcome the behavior, or from our side, if it's our negative behavior, is the four opponent powers to have that regret and make a strong determination not to do it again. So if we can really avoid cognitive fusion in terms of ourselves and others, that's going to be very helpful as a basis to avoid mental afflictions and helpful as a basis to develop loving kindness and compassion for ourselves and others. And then, of course, with that mindfulness is to simply be aware of all the appearances arising in our life. And again, I think an important point here related to what I've just said is when some difficult situation arises, is to not label that as a problem. Because if we label it as a problem, problems are things we don't want, we will automatically have aversion to that problem. Rather, what we understand is that this difficult situation, in fact, it's often difficult situations that are the reason we develop as a person. It forces us to reevaluate and develop. So these difficult situations are actually opportunities. Of course they're difficult, but they're opportunities. So if we can see them as an opportunity and not as a problem, then we're not going to develop aversion to them and we'll want to work through them. And so therefore I think this is going to be very helpful in our day as well when we're faced with difficult situations, not to see them as a problem but as an opportunity. Of course I'm not suggesting we need to go out and search for problems or suffering. We'll encounter enough of that. And then, of course, in those difficult situations, to not have aversion, to practice that acceptance that we talked about a number of times, and then to work through those difficult situations. And also we can use this Tonglen approach to make that difficult situation, particularly if it's some sort of suffering experience, to make it meaningful through the Tonglen meditation. So we can do this as well on top of that. And then at the end of the day, I think it's also good to finish the day on a good way. Of course, if we have time and energy, another meditation in the evening is a very good thing to do. But many of us are quite tired, exhausted from our day. One thing I think at least we can do before we go to bed is to review the day. How did our day go? And if we notice there are any particularly negative things that we've done, then apply these four opponent powers. The regret, the reliance, meaning reaffirm the positive direction we want to follow our life, think of some sort of practical remedy for that, and then make a strong determination not to do that negative thing the following day. So this is a good way of then purifying our mind of that negative imprint and the negative tendency. And it's a good way of also letting go of that negativity from the day. Because often when something negative's happened, we're dwelling on it and we're churning it over and over and over in our mind. We can't seem to let go of it, and often that impacts our ability to sleep as well. So if we go through this purification process, we can also let go of that negativity because we've dealt with it. But also I think equally important, maybe even more important in our modern society, is to focus on the positive, because we tend to always focus on the negative. So at the end of the day, also to reflect on our day in terms of all the good things we did during the day. And again, if we notice we've done some really good things in the day, is to rejoice in those activities. But again, no cognitive fusion. Don't praise ourselves. That's just going to lead to a big head thinking we're special. Rather, praise our behaviour, be happy about doing that, and make a strong determination to continue to do that positive behaviour the following day. And that's going to strengthen our positive imprints and our positive habits. And at the same time, then, have a very balanced view of ourselves. What also we can do at the end of the day, as we go to sleep in bed, then lie in the corpse posture, the Shavasana, flat on our back, arms a little bit to the side, and then engage in a little bit of mindfulness of breathing. So simply notice the breathing, the sensations of the breath throughout the body, emphasizing relaxation. Just relax, relax, relax. Release any tension. Sometimes we have a lot of tension still in our body and mind from the day. So just release that, release that, release that on each out-breath. And so this is a mindfulness practice. It's a way of releasing any physical and mental tension from the day. And then it'll be a good transition into sleep. We do that as long as we can maintain some focus. When we start to get very drowsy, then mentally note, okay, my meditation is finished now, and then move out of that posture into whatever position we use for sleep. In that way, we can always associate that posture with meditation, which means also then we can use this in our meditation practice. If we happen to have some fatigue, or we have some problem with our knee or back or something where we can't sit normally, then we can simply use that posture for our practice, lying down. So that is perfectly acceptable to use as a posture in our practice. But then I would only use that posture for meditation, and then associate that posture with meditation. So that's a little bit how we can structure the day. Now a little bit in terms of reading material. So, of course, here we've been following the Lam Rim Chenmo. And so within that, there are many different topics. And, of course, these days there are many different books available. And I think a lot of it comes down to our personal preference in terms of style of the author. Personally, I like things that are very clearly written. Other people prefer things that are much, maybe more inspirational. Certainly, what I appreciate is a lot of His Holiness Dalai Lama's books, particularly a lot of the more recent books that have come out. Again, often they've been edited by Jeffrey Hopkins, who's very clear and precise. So I find these books very readable and very helpful. Also, of course, I've been quoting from this Attention Revolution from Alan Wallace. I also find his approach to writing is very clear and methodical. So if that's sort of your perspective, I can really recommend any books from Alan Wallace and His Holiness Dalai Lama. Within that, of course, within Alan Wallace books, the one I was referring to most was this Attention Revolution. It's a book about shamatha practice, so he very methodically goes through using the breath, the mind, and then the awareness of awareness practice. Also, intermingled there, he has chapters on the four immeasurables, so he discusses the loving kindness, compassion, empathetic joy, equanimity, tonglen practice. He also has a couple of chapters there about lucid dreaming and dream yoga as well. So I think this can be a very good book to help in those areas of practice. In terms of the emptiness practice, I already mentioned one book that I often recommend in the beginning phase is How to See Yourself as You Really Are from His Holiness Dalai Lama. So I find that can be a good book to begin with. Then in terms of all these six perfections and bodhicitta and so forth, then of course often the text that is used as a basis for describing these practices within Tibetan Buddhism at least is this classic text from Shantideva, the Bodhisattva Charya Avatara, or sometimes in English translated as the Bodhisattva's Way of Life or Entering into the Bodhisattva's Deeds. And there are a number of different translations of it. So this can be something helpful in terms of bodhicitta and the six perfections. But remember, it is written in verse form. So often then, sometimes the verses can be a little bit cryptic. So it's often good then to also receive an explanation. So if you find someone is giving a teaching on Shantideva's text, then I think that could be a good place to begin with that. Also, of course, I referred a couple of times to this What Makes You Not a Buddhist book from Songsa Khyentse. So that can also be a nice book to read because he has a very modern perspective. And this book, of course, was talking about these four seals, about all things being impermanent, all contaminated things are suffering, everything is empty and selfless and nirvana is peace. So that packs that out as well. So that can be a good topic area in terms of philosophical view. If you're interested in Tantra Vajrayana practice, then a book I can really recommend is called The Psychology of Buddhist Tantra by Rob Preece. It's a very well-written book, particularly from a perspective of Western psychology, so we can really appreciate what Tantra is or Vajrayana from a little bit more of the Western psychology perspective. And I think this can be an excellent book to really get an appreciation of what Tantra and Vajrayana really is. Similar to that, there's another book called Introduction to Tantra from Lama Yeshe, the founder of this organization. So this also, I think, can be a very good book if we're interested in Tantra as an introduction into it. So again, there's many, many books. And so again, I think a lot of it's to do with the style of the author. So try and find something that you resonate with. Then again, as I mentioned, it's very helpful earlier. I mentioned that it's very helpful to on a regular basis, at least once a year, to attend a group retreat or course to deepen our understanding, deepen our practice. In general, as a beginner, if we want to do some sort of retreat, very much recommended to start with group retreat, because as an individual, I think it's going to be very difficult because we don't have the perseverance and the ability with too many distractions. So if we can attend initially some group retreats, that will be best. Once we get some momentum in that, then we can start to do some maybe short personal retreats after that. So what we can attend, of course, if we find that this Lam Rim approach suits us, then often a next step that people go into, if they can manage, is that once a year in November, in fact it's going on as we speak, is the 1 month November course in Kopan Monastery in Kathmandu in Nepal. So if we have the ability to follow that, that would be fantastic. Other than that, of course, here they're running very regular programs, and this Lam Rim retreat that we've followed is run on an annual basis. So again, we shouldn't think that now we've done this, we've ticked that off, let's do something else. Often in the beginning phase, it's good to go over these things a number of times. So you maybe after a year, it's good to get a sort of refresher on this, come back again and do the whole thing again. So we shouldn't think that it's like we've finished with that, let's do something else now. But of course, within that, there are maybe certain topic areas that really interest us and we're drawn to it, then we can look for an appropriate course or retreat that is focusing on that. So here again, I think they're offering a number of these things during the year. And then, of course, what can be helpful if we can't manage to do that is to at least follow a course at home. And often many places or many, you can get the audio from a course or retreat and go through it yourself at home. Of course, it's not the same as actually going there and getting the group energy and not being distracted by things. But of course, if we can't manage to do that, then we can actually follow through often some of these courses at home through the audio. And there, so there are many places where you can get the audio for these sorts of courses and just download them and then go through them sort of a little bit each week. So this can also be a very good thing to do when we're at home. And on that note, I have my own website, glennsvenson.org, and I have some audio from various programs I run. So you feel free to download any of that. And also I've put a lot of material up there, charts and so forth, so help yourself. And also there is a contact page on there. So if you ever have any questions, then you can send me a message and I'll try and answer any questions you have. So that's available. What I can recommend if you really want to get a lot more into particularly this shamatha practice and you want to sort of follow some audio for a retreat, then I've got some a 10-day shamatha retreat that I run, the audio of that on here. But also Alan Wallace, he really runs these things very regularly, and he has his organization, there's a website called sbinstitute.com, Santa Barbara Institute, that's in, of course, Southern California. And he, on that website, has a lot of audio from his retreats. In particular, every year he runs this 8-week retreat in Phuket in Thailand. These podcasts are on here, freely available, so you can download those and listen to the meditations and a lot of the instructions for that. So I think that can be also a good resource. And that's about everything I wanted to say. I think I've run out of steam. So any last questions anyone has before we wrap up? Yes.
The recordings that you've been doing, is there any plan from the recordings of this class?
I think there is, but Heidi can probably answer that.
Yeah, that's part of the tricky thing about
transferring them. Could we mail you a flash drive?
What's that?
Can we mail you a flash drive?
We could do, yeah.
3 gigabytes. Yeah, well, yeah, flash drive will handle that now, yeah. So yeah. That's no problem. Yeah, Dropbox, 3 gigabytes. Mm-hmm. Something. Yeah.
Thank you. Do you have any Lojong recommendations as far as texts?
Yeah. In Lojong, the two principal texts that often are taught in Tibetan Buddhism is the 7-point mind training and the 8 verses of mind training. The 8 verses of mind training is a very short text. As it suggests, there are 8 4-line verses. The 7-point mind training then is a little bit more extensive, but it's also in these very pithy, short instructions. And actually on my website, that's one of the programs I regularly run. And I think my website, I think it's called Wisdom and Compassion 7-point Mind Training. And so I've got the audio for that for a whole 10-day program, 9-day program. And also then there is the 7-point mind training text there as well available. So you can follow that. And of course, there are many books on 7-point mind training. Alan Wallace has 2 books on that. I think one's called 7-point mind training and the other one is called Buddhism with an Attitude. So that, if you're going to follow that, that could be a good book to read as well for the basis of that. Because again, the 7-point, the text is just one line statements, you know, like many of them. So you have to sort of unpack them. I mean, some of them are a little bit obvious, but others not. So it's always good to get a commentary on that. And so then you can follow a book like that. And then, like I said, the audio, I got the audio for one of those 9-day courses I run on the 7-point mind training with meditations and everything. So you can grab that. Anything else anyone would like to bring up? Yeah.
When did you do the program in Italy?
I did that from, I think, 98 to 2004. The second cycle of that program finished last year, and they're actually starting a new master's program in Italy next year. Often people... Yeah, oh, you've got the information. I mean, often people ask me about that, and actually, in general, I discourage people. Not because it's a bad program, but because it's not the program that most people are looking for. Most people are looking for a program where they can get more immersed in this Buddhism, particularly the Tibetan Buddhism, and to a point where they can use that as a framework for their practice. So if that's our motivation, this is not really the right program, because this is quite advanced. There's a more intermediate level program within the FPMT, a 2-year program. It's called the basic program, but it's not basic. It's the intermediate level. And so this, I think, if people want to really immerse themselves for that reason, that is a much more appropriate program. Some centres run it as a 2-year full-time. Some centres run it as a part-time or even online over usually about 5 years. This, of course, is 6 or 7-year full-time program. This could be suitable if we want to be a scholar and we want to maybe teach these topics. So then this could be appropriate for us. But now I think also a prerequisite for this is to have more or less done that intermediate level anyway. Anything else anyone would like to bring up?
Yes. Our class collectively came up with this idea to give you some offer. Anybody wants to do that?
Getting embarrassed. Yeah. Thank you very much. Thank you. So I'd just like to finish then by first of all thanking Vajrapani for inviting me here and looking after me so well. And also, of course, I'd like to thank Venerable Dolma here for leading all the meditations. And lastly, though, I'd like to thank all of you for making the time and effort to come here. And I really hope that you receive some benefit from these 10 days. And if you have, then please take it home and use it to improve your life, to become a better person and try and help those around you as much as you can. So.